Tonight only works if, when we leave here, you take the spirit of debate, dialogue, and discussion out with you. We're not going to solve anything tonight. We might get disturbed, we might get upset, but we're not going to solve anything. The only way to solve something is to take it out with you and continue the struggle. And it is a struggle. It's a struggle on an individual level. It's a struggle on a small community level. It's a struggle on a national level. And what is the struggle? It's a struggle of basic citizenship. Because when we take a look at the war in Iraq today, what does it represent? Well, we can sit here and blame Bush all we want. And believe me, he is worthy of blame, and his administration is worthy of blame. But if we're honest, we'd also blame Bill Clinton, because his administration initiated the policies of regime change, of lying and misrepresenting intelligence data to the American people to sustain the notion of an Iraqi threat worthy of military action. So it's not a Republican war. It's not a Democratic war. What we're talking about is an American war. The Iraq war is a manifestation of our failure as a nation, our failure as a people to do the right thing. Now, why did we fail? It's a failure of citizenship. It's a failure of citizenship in that, you know, we the people, and those are important terms, we the people, where does that come from? The preamble of the Constitution of the United States of America, a document that defines who we are and what we are as a people, a document that sets forth the ideals and values, that says we are a nation of law, that we believe in the rule of law, due process, checks and balances. And you know, we have a whole host of people over there in Iraq right now, 138,000 of them, who have taken an oath to uphold and defend that Constitution with their lives, against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And they're over there fighting and dying tragically and killing and being maimed physically and psychologically as we speak. Right now, men and women, American citizens, American heroes, the finest our country can breed, are strapping on their boots, putting on their body armor, and going forth in a day that they don't know whether or not they're going to see the sun set. And given the nature of combat, they may not see the sun rise because they tend to go out before the sun rises. That's the reality, ladies and gentlemen. They're off there engaged in a life and death struggle. For what reason? See, they don't get to engage in a constitutional debate about what they're doing. They signed up, they took an oath, they got trained, and they were over there doing their job. And any one of us here who thinks that when you go to war, you can do so in a controlled fashion. You know, like these are well-trained guys, they're gals, they're Americans. They know the difference between right and wrong. So when they go to war, it's going to be copacetic. That our young men and women are going to do the right thing. They won't be excessive in their violence or excessive in their actions. If you believe that, you've never been to war. You have no clue what war is. Think about the actions of a drowning person as they're going under and the rescue swimmer's coming out to rescue them. What's the biggest threat? That the drowning person is going to take the rescuer down with them. Why? Because they're scared, they're afraid, they're panicked, they're doing whatever they feel necessary to survive. And that's what happens when you go to war. That's what happens when you're engaged in combat, ladies and gentlemen. You're scared. You're scared sick. You're afraid, not just for yourselves, but your friends. And you're going to do whatever is necessary to survive. War is the most horrible thing that mankind can inflict on mankind because it's about one thing and one thing only, killing. It's kill or be killed. End of story. So let's not put too much burden on troops we've already burdened with the most heavy burden of all, waging war. Why do we say no? It's up to the troops to resolve this thing. It's their fault they're over there. It's their fault they're so. It's not their fault. It's our fault. You see, they don't get to engage in a constitutional debate about the war. It's not their responsibility. It's our responsibility. And collectively, we abrogated our responsibility because we didn't have a debate. We didn't have a dialogue. We didn't have a discussion on a national level about Iraq before we went to war in Iraq. We can blame George W. Bush. I do. We can blame Bill Clinton. I do. We can blame the Congress of the United States. I do. We can blame the media. I do. But until we get honest with ourselves and look in the mirror and say, have I behaved as a genuine American citizen? Have I done everything necessary to be a good citizen? Not too many of us can answer that question yes, if we're honest. Because at the end of the day, the vast majority of us are better consumers than we are citizens. We're a hell of a lot better at getting up in the morning and going to work and earning a paycheck than finding ways to spend that paycheck than we are about familiarizing ourselves with the Constitution that defines who we are and what we are as a people. We're a heck of a lot better figuring out how we're going to support the Seattle Seahawks as they get ready to defend their division title, or we're getting ready for the upcoming baseball season, memorizing the statistics of our favorite baseball player, than we are about reading the Constitution and determining who we are and what we are as a people. We're pretty good at a lot of things. We're not very good at being citizens. Because, first of all, you can't be an American citizen unless you know what it means to be an American. And consumerism does not define being an American, regardless of what George W. Bush said. I know after 9/11 he said the most patriotic thing we can do is to go out to the mall and shop. I would like to believe the most patriotic thing we could have done is to sit back and reflect on who we are and what we are as a people and how we're going to respond to a national tragedy. We're a nation of laws. And yet, after 9/11, there seems to be a tendency for us to be dismissive of the law. The Constitution that defines who we are and what we are as a people has become an impediment, an obstacle to moving forward. You hear this every day, the Patriot Act debate. We can't let the Constitution become a suicide document, people say. It's not. Well, it is. Just ask the men and women who have died in its defense. If you're willing to give your life for the document, that means it's a document that has to be defended at all costs, especially when 19 terrorists hijack 4 airplanes and fly them into 4 buildings and kill 3,000 Americans, especially when our nation is under attack. It's at that time it becomes more important than ever that we identify with our foundational ideals and values, and that is set forth only in one form, the Constitution. And yet we seem to have a collective yawn when we find out that the president has ordered warrantless wiretappings to infringe on the individual civil liberties of American citizens. Congress says, well, that's okay. We'll just find a way to backfill legally, come up with justification after the fact. No, there's no justification for the infringement on individual civil liberties. There can never be justification for the infringement on individual civil liberties. If we're not about defending the individual, we are about nothing as a nation. And if we're not about backing up our troops by ensuring that before we send them off to fight and die in a conflict, that we have done everything necessary, A, to ensure that war is the absolute last option sought, and B, that it's a conflict worthy of the sacrifice we're asking these troops to make, we have collectively failed. On Iraq, ladies and gentlemen, we, the people of the United States of America, rushed off to war. I know there's individuals out here that say, not me. Don't blame me. Don't lump me into that. Guys, we're part of the same team. Team America. 300 million Americans. And while you might be able to come up with a certain number, I don't know, what do we call it? 5 million? 10 million? Let's say 20 million Americans actively fought against this war. That means 280 million Americans are either for this war or didn't do a darn thing to stop this war. So we collectively failed. We rushed off to war. Why? For a number of reasons. One, we're ignorant. We're an extremely ignorant people. The United States of America, for the being one of the most technologically advanced nations on the face of the earth, is populated by perhaps the single most ignorant group of people about the world we live in. It's a statement of fact. We don't know anything about the world we live in. And yet we have the hubris to believe that 300 million people get to dictate the terms of interaction with the rest of the globe, several billion other people. It's sort of an America-centric universe. The sun revolves around America. If it isn't good for America, then it's not good for anybody. We come first. This lifestyle that we're addicted to, it's a lifestyle we can't sustain with resources available to our country. And so we go out and we gain access to these resources on terms favorable to us. In the case of Iraq, it's part of a region that has a lot of oil in it. We have an economy that runs on oil. Therefore, we somehow say, yeah, it's okay for us to be focused on a region to try and shape events in that region so that we can gain access to those resources on terms favorable to us. But, you know, a lot of Americans would say, nah, you know, I'm not too comfortable about going to war for oil. Okay, I buy into that. So how else do we package this war? It's a struggle between good and evil. That's one way people like to package it. And we were very good about demonizing Saddam Hussein in Iraq over the course of several decades, to the point that we would accept at face value anything negative put out about Saddam Hussein without question. I could come up with any statement I want about the crimes of Saddam in the months and years leading up to the war in 2003, and they would not be questioned. But God help you if you raised your hand and say, wait a minute, I question that fact. Then you were accused of being pro-Saddam, sympathetic to the dictator. We don't know enough about Iraq to be able to question any negative statement made about Iraq. From our ignorance comes fear. And that fear allows us to be exploited. And that fear was magnified greatly after 9/11, the events of 9/11, where collectively we were told to be afraid. I mean, the government went so far as to create a national mood ring, different colors, that basically would dictate the terms of the fear. Today it is condition orange, be afraid. Tomorrow is condition red, be very afraid. We can go to condition yellow sometimes, don't be too afraid, but still be afraid. We have conditioned the American people to be afraid. What is the biggest enemy of fear? Knowledge. But how many Americans have sought the knowledge and information necessary to empower themselves so they're no longer afraid? Not too many. Again, what I'm getting at is a collective responsibility, a collective failure of citizenship. And it manifests itself here tonight. Where are the people of Seattle? Do you give a damn? Do you really care? You guys do. You're here. You know, this isn't about me. This isn't about, you know, me speaking. This is about people given enough to come out and talk about an issue that involves 138,000 fellow Americans over in Iraq. The President of the United States sent them there 3 years ago. He said there was a threat in Iraq in the form of weapons of mass destruction that justified military intervention. Well, it turns out that that threat didn't exist. He said there were weapons of mass destruction, massive stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. They aren't there. Now, I've told you in the past, we knew they weren't there. This wasn't an intelligence mistake. This wasn't an intelligence failure. This was deliberate misrepresentation of fact on the part of the United States government, not just George W. Bush, but Bill Clinton before him. Now imagine, put yourself for a second, and there might be some people in here that you don't have to imagine. Tragically, this may have happened to you. But I can tell you, as a former Marine Corps officer who has been to war for my country, one of the worst things that can ever happen to you, and thankfully I didn't have to do it, I know people who have done it, you have to write letters home to the families of those who have fallen in combat. Now imagine being a Marine Corps rifle company commander in March of 2003, and you got to write a letter home now to explain why Lance Corporal Smith is dead. Now, you don't want to talk about how he died. You don't want to talk about the awful fact that he's probably in an Amtrak armored vehicle that got hit by a high explosive round that sealed the hatch so he couldn't get out while the vehicle burned. You don't want to talk about how his platoon rushed in and tried to rip the hatch off, burning their hands to the bone, but had to back away before the vehicle blew up, listening to him scream as he burned to death. You don't want to say that. No, you got to make the death palatable. You got to bring justification for it. So the first thing you do is you say, Lance Corporal Smith was a good man. Probably. Probably not that good of a man. No, if he's like all the Lance Corporals I knew. Probably drank to excess, womanized, swore, cursed. If you go through his bags, you might find things you don't want to ship home. But no, he was a good man, because you want that thought to be there. This is a letter that the family has to read every Christmas when they took a look at that gap under the tree where presents should be for Lance Corporal Smith. This is a letter that has to be read at every Thanksgiving when you look at the empty chair around the table. This is a letter that has to be read at birthdays. This is a letter that has to be read at anniversaries. This is a letter that families have to fall back on repeatedly as they miss their loved one. So it better be a damn good letter, so you don't say anything bad about Lance Corporal Smith. He's a good man, well loved by his teammates. And you should rest peacefully knowing that he died in a cause worthy of the sacrifice. He died freeing the world of the threat of weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein posed an ugly threat. Remember, this being written in March 2003 as we go to war. Saddam Hussein posed an ugly threat. And your son died trying to free the world of that threat. I'm writing this letter. It sounds like a great letter in March 2003. Imagine the family reading that letter today, knowing that it was a lie. How does it make them feel? How does it make every American feel to know that every single soldier, sailor, airman, and marine who died in the initial phases of that war died for a lie? But that's okay. The Bush administration continually readmits reasons for us to be in Iraq. So now let's talk about the soldier that died in August 2003. In an incipient insurgency, an improvised explosive device goes off and blows up his Humvee, takes his leg off, he's tossed out into a ditch, and he bleeds out before the medic can get to him, screaming out, "Mommy, mommy, mommy," while it happens. No, you don't want to write that, because you don't talk about the horror of war. You say, Corporal Jones was a good man, God-loving man, who loved his family. Might be true, might not be true. Again, like I said, we don't want to put our soldiers on too high of a pedestal. They're human beings just like all of us. But this is a letter the family has to read, ladies and gentlemen, on every holiday. So you say he was a good man who loved his family. And he died in a good cause, the liberation of the people of Iraq. There are a few dead-enders out there who are resisting the liberation, but for the most part, the Iraqi people want us there, and your son died in a good cause. Read that letter today, ladies and gentlemen, and tell me what kind of solace it brings to the family. It doesn't, because we're not there as the liberators of Iraq. We're there as the brutal occupiers of Iraq, a reality that plays itself out constantly on TV. Imagine being the family that received that letter, or be the ones that said, your son died in the cause of bringing democracy to the people of Iraq, defending a polling place. How does that feel today? Democracy in Iraq? What democracy in Iraq? Your son died to bring a Shia theocracy that's pro-Iranian? Is that what your son died for? The fact of the matter is, there's nothing you can say about Iraq that justifies the loss of a single American life. And yet, we, the people of the United States, worship war. We're addicted to war. We love it. We wade into it. We think it's great. We make movies about it. We have television programs about it. When we go to war, it's a national celebration. Think about it. Think about it. People going, USA, USA, USA. You turn on the television like it's some grand damn piece of information, entertainment. A little video game, a little fun. We worship war. It's great. When our nation goes to war, we should drape black over everything. We should toll the bells. We should mourn nationally as we send our youth off to die. But we celebrate it. We celebrate it. And that's the problem. We're addicted. We're sick. And we're not going to be able to resolve this problem till we admit that. We're not just a nation addicted to oil. We're not just a nation addicted to a lifestyle we can't sustain independently. We're a nation addicted to war. We're a nation addicted to violence. It's a sickness that manifests itself not only in Iraq, but in Iran. We're going to go to war with Iran. And we're going to fall for the same smoke and mirror trick that we fell for in Iraq. A threat from weapons of mass destruction against the national security of the United States, where the United Nations is unable or unwilling to deal with it. Therefore, we have no choice but to act preemptively, unilaterally, militarily. And yet, where are the American people? Where are the people of Seattle? Those peace-loving, tree-hugging people of Seattle, the good people of Seattle who are so against this war. So against this war that they're sort of blind, that not only that we're engaged in a war today, but we're on our way to another war tomorrow. And it's not just the people of Seattle. It's the people of America. This is happening across this country. I don't know what the problem is. Is it that we've become so tired of turning on the television and seeing about Iraq that we just simply stopped caring? Have we been overloaded with Iraq? It's not going away, ladies and gentlemen. That's the other lesson we need to learn. In our addiction to war, we play these video games. Wonderful little games. I played them. I'm guilty of it. I'm not a hypocrite. But you know, as you're navigating your way through the game and you get hit, you go, oops, and you hit the reset button. Well, the soldiers don't get to hit the reset button in combat. When that bullet impacts their head and blows their brains out the back, it's over. And somehow we don't recognize that collectively as a people. We sent them to war, and yet we sit there and we allow the president to say we must stay the course, because to withdraw now would dishonor the sacrifice made by those who have fallen. Well, with all due respect, Mr. President, you dishonored their sacrifice the day you sent them to war for a cause unworthy of their sacrifice. You sent them to war on the basis of a lie. And yet we want to sustain the course. And it's not just the Republicans saying this. It's the Democrats. We have politicians who lack the intestinal fortitude to stand up and speak truth about this war. Even Representative Murtaugh of Pennsylvania, who has been much applauded for his anti-war stance. I have a simple question for Jack Murtaugh. When did the war become a bad war? When we lost 2,000 Americans? When we lost 2,100 Americans? I mean, at what point? See, Mr. Murtaugh likes to believe that we were justified in going to war against Iraq, that getting rid of Saddam Hussein was a good thing, and that somehow it's because we fumbled the invasion that it's now a bad thing. Shame on you, Mr. Murtaugh. If this is a war worth fighting, then we should be willing to lose 2,000, 4,000, 10,000, 20,000, 50,000, 100,000 Americans if necessary. If this is genuinely a life and death struggle where our nation feels compelled to send our youth off to die, then we should be able to be willing to lose all of our youth if that's what's required. No, Iraq is not a war worth one American. It was a bad war the moment we crossed the line of departure. But until our political leaders are willing to accept that, they continue to leave open the possibility of sustaining the conflict. We don't want to bring dishonor on the troops who have fallen, so we will continue to fight to ensure that more troops fall. But we don't want to dishonor those troops, so we continue to fight and even have more troops fall. It's a never-ending cycle. At some point in time, we're going to have to acknowledge that they have died in vain, that their losses cannot ever be justified, that this was a bad war. It doesn't mean the troops were bad. The troops aren't bad. The leadership is bad, and we, the people who tolerate bad leadership, are bad. It's not the troops that are bad. But people will say, no, if you pull out, you're shaming the troops. You're not supporting the troops. One of the first things I learned as a lieutenant in the Marine Corps is you don't reinforce failure. If you're banging your head against a brick wall, eventually you got to realize it hurts, and maybe it's time to either go over the wall, around the wall, or walk away from the wall. But you don't keep banging your head against the wall. We are banging our head against the wall in Iraq, and we are deluding ourselves into believing that this is success. And therefore, we're willing to consider banging our heads against another wall called Iran. We bought into the lies about Iraq because we were ignorant about Iraq. We accepted at face value anything negative put forward about Iraq to the point that anybody who dared question the president's case for going to war was called treasonous, unpatriotic, supportive of the devil. It's because we didn't know the facts. Some people will say, well, that's water under the bridge when it comes to Iraq. We're there. We have to deal with the situation now. I agree and I disagree. We're there and we have to deal with the situation. What does deal with the situation mean? Solving the problem. How do you solve a problem if you haven't defined the problem? You know, if you're seeking a solution void of a definition of what it is you're trying to solve, you're solving nothing. And you can't define the problem of Iraq unless you talk about how we got to that war. Because that is the problem. We're told it was an intelligence mistake. Oops, we got it wrong. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you, and the facts support me, it wasn't an intelligence mistake. You can only make a mistake on disarming Iraq if you intended to disarm Iraq from day one. What we now know is that the policy of the United States was not disarmament, but regime change. It's not only reflected in my experience as a weapons inspector. Read the Downing Street memo, circa July 2002, where the British government comes back from a meeting with the Bush administration and says, the Bush administration has committed to war in Iraq. They're using as an excuse weapons of mass destruction and a link with Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. But the evidence is weak. The Bush administration is in the process of fixing intelligence around the policy, making it up, so to speak. And they did. They made it up. We had the vice president in August 2002 talk about the defection of Hussein Kamal, Saddam Hussein's son-in-law, saying that Hussein Kamal's defection in August of 1995 is the only thing that allowed UN weapons inspectors to realize they were being misled by the Iraqis regarding a biological weapons program. Hussein Kamal's defection also, according to the vice president, put us on notice that the Iraqis were actively reconstituting their nuclear weapons program. Wow. I happen to be the guy who led the investigation into Hussein Kamal's defection. I've interfaced with the CIA people who debriefed him. I've interfaced with the British intelligence people who debriefed him. I've interfaced with the Jordanians and the UN teams that debriefed Hussein Kamal. It's amazing what he said. First of all, let's set the chronology straight. He defected in August 1995. Thanks to the hard work of UN weapons inspectors, the Iraqi government forced to admit in April 1995 that they had a biological program that they had been lying about. In July 1995, 1 month before Hussein Kamal's defection, the Iraqi government had to acknowledge they had an offensive biological weapons program. So with all due respect to the vice president, although this is an administration that believes it can create its own reality, they haven't invented a time machine yet that allows them to go back and have Hussein Kamal somehow magically defect before the inspectors figured out. They were lying. See, the vice president was trying to build the case that inspectors couldn't do the job. He was trying to impart that we can't rely on UN inspectors, that they're a bunch of Keystone cops. No, We did the job. We figured it out. We didn't just figure out in 1995 that the Iraqis were lying to us about biological weapons. We figured out by the end of that year that we could account for all of their biological weapons. By 1994, we had figured out that we could account for the vast majority of their chemical weapons. By 1993, we had determined that there was no more nuclear weapons program in Iraq. By 1992, we had determined that they didn't have any ballistic missile capability. We couldn't account for 100% of everything, but we could mitigate against the unaccounted for material. And notice I say unaccounted for material, and I'm not saying that the Iraqis were hiding it from us. I'm saying we couldn't account for it. Couldn't tell you what the final disposition was. We could mitigate against that by noting that by 1995, we had in place in Iraq the most intrusive, technologically advanced on-site inspection regime in the history of arms control. Nothing even came close to what we were doing in Iraq. No notice inspections, cameras, sensors, and this blanketed the totality of Iraq's industrial infrastructure. Every factory that was involved in producing WMD, every factory that could have been involved in producing WMD, and we never once detected any evidence of a reconstituted or retained weapons of mass destruction program. Good work. But that's not what the Bush administration wanted to say. They wanted to create the perception of a non-compliant Iraq. Well, he lied, Dick Cheney. George Bush said in October of 2002 that he knows Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, knows that they have them. Now, I'm a simple Marine. I can butcher the English language six ways from Sunday. But I'm here to tell you right now, when someone says they know something, that implies certainty of knowledge. That means they're in possession of some facts that give them a basis for this. And all I ask as an American citizen that my commander-in-chief share these facts with me. Now, I know we can't share all the facts, you know, because some of them are secret. And you don't want to give away those sources and methods that are so valuable to the intelligence community. That's why we have a Congress that's empowered with oversight responsibilities. That's why we have a Senate Select Intelligence Committee. That's why we have a House Intelligence Oversight Committee. These are our elected representatives, the people's representatives, who are supposed to receive this data and say, yes, Mr. President, on behalf of the people of the United States of America, we agree. But the president didn't do that. He didn't share him any information. And when he did provide data, it was a lie. Deliberately distorted, falsified data. Now, some will say, well, Congress didn't know any better. No, they knew. The amazing thing is Congress knew they were being lied to. I'll give you an example. The summer of 2002, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has a hearing on Iraq. And they're bringing together the best witnesses that can possibly be assembled on that. Maybe. I don't know. I'm not saying I'm the best person on Iraq, but a little knowledgeable. They didn't invite me. No, you see, they didn't want people who come up with the facts. Their job was to shape public opinion. They brought in somebody named Hidra Hamza. You might know him. He's Saddam's bomb maker. At least he wrote a book that said, Saddam's bomb maker. He's the guy, apparently, that was doing all this dirty stuff with nuclear weapons. Amazing man. Except that he's a liar. And that CIA knew he was a liar. They knew from the moment he defected that this man was a liar. In fact, Hussein Kamal, that guy that Dick Cheney likes to quote, Hussein Kamal said when he defected that Hidra Hamza was a known liar, a fabricator. He also said some amazing things, because remember Dick Cheney was trying to say that Hussein Kamal said that they had a reconstituted nuclear weapons program. When I read the documents and talk to people, my understanding is that Hussein Kamal said all weapons of mass destruction were destroyed, that nothing remained. So I'm always curious as to what document Dick Cheney must have been referring to when he talked about Hussein Kamal and his defection. Because it wasn't anything I was familiar with. The fact is, it wasn't anything that exists. He simply made it up. But they allowed Hidra Hamza to testify in open session with TV cameras broadcast to the American people. Now, one can excuse the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in perhaps being misled about Hidra Hamza's resume. No, every single member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee knew that the CIA had already identified Hidra Hamza as a fabricator, a liar, that he wasn't who he said he was. And yet they allowed him to testify without question. and give the American people the perception that Iraq was reconstituting a nuclear weapons program, so that when Condoleezza Rice says, we don't want the smoking gun to come in the form of a mushroom cloud, the fearful, ignorant American people sucked in their breath and he said, yes, you're right, we don't want that. Instead of saying, it could never happen, isn't going to happen. We knew that the case for a war, when I say we, the government knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq worthy of military intervention. And yet they allowed the American people to be misled. Why? Because no politician had the courage to stand up and challenge conventional wisdom. No politician was willing to put his or her career on the line. No politician of national stature. We know that there's a handful, including Jim McDermott, a very brave man who deserves your continued support in these difficult times. He had the courage to stand up and say no in the face of this overwhelming pressure to rush towards war. He wasn't addicted to war. He wasn't addicted to violence, but sadly the rest of the nation was and is. Because we're making the same mistake today. On Iran. We hear that there's a nuclear threat out there, that Iran has a nuclear weapons program, and that this represents a danger. But they provide no evidence whatsoever to back this up. In fact, if you read the reports of the UN inspectors who are in Iran, they will tell you that there is no evidence that Iran has a nuclear weapons program, none whatsoever. There's concerns about what Iran might have been doing in the past, about what they potentially could do in the future, but there's no evidence that Iran is producing nuclear weapons or has a nuclear weapons program. But if you listen to the administration, they will tell you that it's going on as we speak. Interesting report from the IAEA says that the Iranians have started spinning up one centrifuge to test loading in gas, and they're going to cascade it to 10. Now we've got the media going, oh my God, this means the Iranians could be on the verge of producing fissile material and have a nuclear bomb before we know it. Geez, we better attack now. And you can just see it in the media, this drumbeat for war. Gosh, wouldn't they like to have some facts? Yeah, the Iranians are spinning up a centrifuge. And they've spun up 10. How do we know? They told us. Why are they doing it? Short-term test to test the rotors, the viability of the magnetic rotors, to see if they can spin them up to 50,000 RPMs without cracking the device. But they can't spin them for a long time with this gas, this UF6. Why? Fundamental fact, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to introduce you to a word. It's a difficult word. I don't even pronounce it right. But it's one that every American better ingrain into their brain. Molybdenum. It's a mineral. MO, I think, is its scientific little abbreviation, atomic weight of 45 or 42 or something like that. But that's not important. It's used in strengthening steel alloy, but that's not important. What's important is that Iran's uranium ore is contaminated with this chemical. Contaminated. They can't get it out. Which means if they process the ore into yellow cake and then turn it into UF4 and then turn it to UF6 and put it into centrifuges and run the centrifuges for any sustained period of time, they will destroy the centrifuges. They won't work. Iran cannot enrich uranium. Can't do it. Isn't happening. They might be able to do it down the road. They might solve this problem, but there's no threat, ladies and gentlemen. There's no need to rush off and go to war against Iran. This is an issue that can and should be dealt with diplomatically. But why aren't we, the people of the United States of America, demanding a slowdown in this mad rush to war? A, we're ignorant. We don't know anything about Iran. We don't know anything about nuclear weapons. We don't know anything about nuclear enrichment. And we accept at face value anything this administration puts out that says Iran represents a threat. Why? How does this ignorance play against us? It makes us afraid. Because you're always afraid of that which you don't know. We're also cowards. Because who wants to stand up and say, time out, Mr. President. And in doing so, say, you are a supporter of the mad mullahs of Tehran. You'd rather that they beat their women, imprison their women, and do all sorts of horrible things in the name of Islamic fundamentalism. No, that wasn't the debate. The debate was about nuclear weapons. And I have a question about the nuclear weapons, but they don't want you to ask that question. If you do, they won't answer it with a technical answer. They'll accuse you of being unpatriotic and treasonous. And no American politician has shown the courage to stand up in the face of the Bush administration's mad rush to war with Iran by asking the simple question, what about molybdenum? An easy question, not an easy word, but it's a question that needs to be asked. But nobody's asking it. I'm asking you to demand from your representatives, from your senators, what about molybdenum? Ask them that question. They say, what? You say, you better damn well learn that word and what it means before you vote for a war. But they won't. They'd rather vote for a war than stand up and do the right thing. Why? Because we're addicted to war, ladies and gentlemen. We're a nation addicted to violence, to war, to death, to destruction. It's good business. It's good for the media. And apparently it fills some sort of sick void in the soul of the American being. And until we recognize this illness, this national illness, and we undertake the means necessary to heal this disease, we, the people of the United States of America, will continue to define ourselves as a nation of warriors and thereby be forever condemned to wage war. Thank you very much. I'll take any questions anybody has.
David and Tom are going to come up here and help you field
questions. It's an outstanding question, and it was a difficult one. You know, as a weapons inspector, the strength of your work of what gives you authority is the mandate of the Security Council. The Security Council in its resolution 687 mandated our existence and the terms of our work in Iraq, which is to destroy, remove, or render harmless chemical weapons, biologic weapons, long-range ballistic missiles, and nuclear weapons, all components thereof, all means of production thereof, all training organizations and units thereof. There's nothing in there that talks about regime change. It also said that economic sanctions will be maintained until which time Iraq complies with its disarmament obligation. But it noted that once Iraq is found to be in compliance, it said that not all sanctions, but the sanction on the sale of oil, will be lifted. Now, Iraq is a nation whose economy revolves around one thing and one thing only, and that's the sale of oil. So if you lift the embargo on the sale of oil, the rest of the sanctions go out the window. Iraq now has a functioning, viable economy. The United States, although it drafted this resolution and voted in favor of this resolution in April 1991, by May 1991 was singing a different tune. James Baker, Secretary of State, appeared before the United States Congress and said, even if Iraq complies with its obligation to disarm, economic sanctions will be maintained until which time Saddam Hussein is removed from power. This statement made our job as inspectors very difficult, because when we went to Iraq and we said, you must comply, they said, why? What's in it for us? Tariq Aziz said this over and over and over again. Why should we do what you want? Why should we surrender our sovereignty, put at risk our national security, when at the end of the day, the United States and Great Britain will never allow economic sanctions to be lifted? Why should we do this? And as inspectors, we had a hard time answering that question. All we could say is that we do not get involved in Security Council politics. That the best thing we can do is to move forward aggressively on the issue of disarmament and show that Iraq has complied so that we can issue a report to the Security Council that will confront the United States with the contradictory nature of its policies, where on the one hand, it votes for a resolution calling for the disarmament of Iraq and saying sanctions will be lifted if Iraq disarms, and on the other hand, the United States saying, oops, we really don't mean that. We're going to keep the sanctions in place even if Iraq has disarmed. What we need to do is force that issue, and so that's what we would tell the Iraqis, is that we have to keep moving forward. We also told the Iraqis, this is a hypothetical discussion so long as you lie to us. So long as you hide weapons, so long as you conceal, we have a hypothetical discussion because you're not in compliance. So we can't even begin to talk about the hypocrisy of the American position until Iraq comes into compliance. Iraq was not didn't even come close to being in compliance until after 1995, when they finally acknowledged the biological weapons program that they had said for 4 years didn't exist. But by 1996, we had investigated all of Iraq's claims, and we pretty much found that the Iraqis were telling the truth. Not 100%, but enough that we could say they are fundamentally disarmed, that there's no way they have viable stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. They no longer present a threat. But that was a conclusion, a finding the United States government would never accept. They kept saying that we have to raise the bar. We have to have 100% certainty. So now we would carry out inspections trying to achieve that 100% certainty. And what we found is the U.S. hijacked that inspection process to spy on Saddam Hussein and attempt to assassinate him, to remove him through a coup d'etat, a process which corrupted the integrity of the UN inspection process so much so that the Iraqis stopped looking at us as people trying to disarm them and started looking at us as people trying to assassinate their president, and they were right. The fact of the matter is Iraq destroyed all of its weapons of mass destruction in the summer of 1991. The CIA today acknowledges this. The CIA also acknowledges that Iraq made no effort to reconstitute weapons of mass destruction capability from 1991 all the way up to 2003. A lot of people say, well, why did Iraq oppose the inspections? And why did they confront the inspections? What was going on there? Well, I've made it as plain as day. By 1991, they may have gotten rid of their weapons, but they were hoping to hold on to the technology so that when inspectors left, they could reconstitute these weapons. By 1993, we had confronted the Iraqis on that, and we're starting to wrap up the technology, bring it under control. But the Iraqis held on to the documents, the brain trust, that it might allow them to reconstitute once sanctions are lifted and inspectors leave. But after the defection of Hussein Kamal, the Iraqis were compelled to turn over the totality of their documents. And in 1996, the Iraqi government said, not only are there no weapons of mass destruction, but we have no intention of ever again having weapons of mass destruction. But that's a finding the U.S. government wouldn't accept. Now, we inspectors would go in trying to look for hidden documents, not weapons, documents, to presidential palaces, presidential security organizations. That's where they blocked us. Not because they were hiding something, but because they were afraid that CIA operatives on the teams were trying to gain access to data that would be used to assassinate their president. It was the American policy of regime change that corrupted the disarmament effort of the UN weapons inspectors. Next question, please. Okay, do I see any possibility, any hope of Shia and Sunnis forming a government of unity in Iraq? First of all, I'm going to say that from an American perspective, I don't care. It's their problem, not my problem. What I care about is that whatever happens in Iraq, no matter how tragic it is for the Iraqi people, it does not constitute a threat to the national security of the United States worthy of the continued presence of American troops. The next thing I'll say is that if there is hope of the Shia and Sunni coming together in a government of national unity, it will only manifest itself when American troops remove themselves from Iraq, because we are the friction that makes such a government impossible. So I don't know if there's hope. I mean, I can sit here and say I have hope, but that might be false hope. What I do know is this. Thanks to the United States of America, by intervening in Iraq the way we did, we removed a brutal dictator, Saddam Hussein, and a form of government, the Ba'athist Party, that for all of its faults represented the glue that held that nation together for 30-plus years. And when we removed it and we didn't replace it with anything viable, Iraq devolved into chaos and anarchy, and that's what we are witnessing today. There will not be an elegant solution to the problem of Iraq. Anybody thinks that you can wave the magic wand, tap the ruby slippers three times, or whatever you want to do, and make the problem go away, you're in la-la land. The Iraqi people are going to have to sort this problem out for themselves, and unfortunately, that means that there will be significant violence, and many Iraqis are going to die. But the bottom line is, this is an Iraqi problem that can only be solved by the people of Iraq, and we need to get our troops out of there. Next question. Well, there's no doubt about that. I mean, it's stunning for me to hear people say, support the troops, And therefore, that means support the war. First of all, don't say support the troops. Say support America. The troops are an extension of America. They represent us. They belong to us. But we can't be focused on the troops. The troops don't exist as an entity of themselves. They represent us. They're there for us. They're there to defend us. And we have a process ongoing in Iraq today that is not only bad for the people of Iraq, but it's one that is harmful to the national security of the United States of America in the most selfish way. We have an all-volunteer force that is the finest military force the world has ever seen. I despise war, I hate war, but I'm here to tell you right now, there's nothing out there right now that can stand toe-to-toe to the American military once we engage in combat. We have the most technologically advanced military, the best led military, the best trained military, the most highly motivated military in the world. And it's there to defend us. But by continuing this ridiculous war in Iraq, because our politicians don't have the courage to stand up and do the right thing, we not only can guarantee that the Iraqi people will continue to suffer down the road and American troops will die, but we are destroying this military. We have a military today that is solely built around waging the global war on terror, with the vast majority of that focused on Iraq. The Army today operates, I believe, 42 combat brigades. 14 of them are engaged actively in ongoing operations in the global war on terror. 14 have just come back from operations in the global war on terror, and 14 are preparing to go and replace those other 14. So you got a rotation taking place where we have no depth, no reserve, nothing. And we're grinding these 14 combat brigades down to nothing. And there's so much disillusionment about the war that people aren't enlisting, people aren't re-enlisting. And so those 14 brigades are even growing smaller and smaller and smaller. What happens if a threat does manifest itself somewhere around the world? Say North Korea. How do we deal with North Korea today? We can't. How do they think they're going to deal with Iran? We can't. We don't have the troops. The war in Iraq is destroying the very military we, the people of the United States of America, are dependent upon for our legitimate national security. It's a very, very dangerous situation that's taking place today. But again, the vast majority of people in the United States of America live their daily lives ignorant of what you just brought up. How are they going to Iran? They're going to bomb Iran. The plan right now is a massive aerial bombardment campaign that's designed not only to retard Iran's nuclear capability, but the vast majority of the targets being considered deal with leadership, deal with command and control, deal with security elements. The idea is that you're going to destabilize the regime of the mullahs to the point that the freedom-loving, democratic-minded people of Iran are going to rise up and replace their government and embrace the United States as the wonderful liberators of their country. That's the plan. And if it doesn't happen, now we're in trouble because we can't back that up with boots on the ground. So where do we go from there? Well, now we got to beat them into submission. But we just gave them our best shot with the conventional weapons. So now we open up a new page, ladies and gentlemen. The United States of America has, for the last couple of years, been developing a new family of weapons called usable nuclear weapons. And we have a new policy on the use of these weapons where we can use nuclear weapons preemptively in a non-nuclear environment. And I think a war with Iran is the perfect opportunity for the Bush administration to unleash the nuclear genie. And the irony of it is that we will drop a nuclear weapon on Iran to prevent it from developing nuclear weapons, thereby setting in motion a sequence of events that can only stop when an American city vaporizes in a nuclear holocaust. Because once we nuke somebody, I tell you what, they will not rest until they deliver the same harsh punishment on American soil. This is insanity, ladies and gentlemen. Absolute insanity. Yes, sir. No, we had this conversation at dinner. I'm an addict, ladies and gentlemen. I stand before you. I acknowledge my addiction to war. I acknowledge my addiction to violence. I acknowledge my addiction to oil. I acknowledge my addiction to global resources. I am an addict. All right? but I'm trying to get on a 12-step program, okay? I'm trying just by acknowledging the fact that I'm an addict, I'm on the path of recovery. I will never stop being an addict, just like you can never stop being an alcoholic. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. You're not a recovering alcoholic. You're an alcoholic, but you acknowledge that you're an alcoholic, and you're trying to take the steps to prevent a relapse into that disease. So it's up to you whether or not you want to trust me as an addict. But at least I'm honest enough to admit my addiction. And I'm trying to do what I can to get myself and this country headed in a direction that frees us from this addiction so my children don't grow up addicted and their children don't grow up addicted to what I am currently addicted to. You know, it's funny. People say, two stolen elections. I love that excuse. My God, those evil neoconservatives stole the election right from under our noses. When 30% of the eligible electorate participated, they didn't steal squat. 70% of America stayed home and didn't do anything. You can't steal an election where people don't participate. I will accept a debate, a discussion, a conversation about stolen election, electronic voting machines, etc., when we get 70% of the American voters out there participating in an election. Until then, we have an abject failure on the part of the American people to abide by their responsibilities of citizenship. You know, dialogue. We have to have a dialogue. A dialogue about what? About war, about that biolab, about the DIA, about all this stuff. It has to be brought out there. We have to discuss. We need to have that dialogue. But that dialogue has to conform with due process. It has to be all-inclusive. It can't be a dialogue among like thinkers. That's not a dialogue that's going to go anywhere. Have that dialogue with VFW, Veteran of Foreign Wars, American Legion, with the dock workers, with the firefighters, with the cops, with the union workers. Go out to the fields of Nebraska and have that dialogue with the corn-fed conservatives out there. That's a dialogue. Okay, we need to have that. Impeachment? Gosh, wouldn't that be nice? Impeachment. You know, but what is impeachment? See, what we're guilty of when we say, impeach the man. Impeach the man, we're guilty of violating due process. You can't have impeachment until you've actually said what he's charged with. Okay, what are we charging him with? Bingo. But are we going to convict him right now of war crimes, or are we going to have due process? We better have due process if you're going to call yourself an American. So you're accusing the man of war crimes? Prove it. Get your congressmen to prove it. Get an investigation in Congress. And you know what? Until you can motivate your elected representatives to do that, don't talk to me about war crimes, because the problem isn't war crimes committed abroad. The problem is a failure of citizenship here at home, because we're not holding our elected representatives accountable. And we can sit here and talk about war crimes all we want. What about civil crimes? What about the fact that we have elected representatives lying to us in the conduct of their official duty? That is a felony. That is much easier to prove than war crimes. So let's take... You know, before we jump to impeachment, it's a wonderful word. It sounds great, makes us feel good, and a lot of Democrats want a little bit of revenge. Impeach George W. because the Republicans rushed to impeach Bill Clinton. But I tell you what, let's just talk about holding people accountable to the rule of law. And right now, we have a whole host of issues that this administration needs to be held accountable to. And if some of those issues, after due process, after a due investigation, we determine that there is just cause for moving forward on grounds for impeachment, then let's do that. But let's not get so focused on the issue of impeachment that we forget this president lied. And lying is not a war crime. Lying is a crime. It's a felony. The vice president lied. Lying is not a war crime. It's a felony. The Congress lied. That's a crime. It's not a war crime. It's a felony. Let's hold them accountable to all the laws they have broken, but let's be careful. We are guilty of making a huge mistake if we sit there and convict them now as we speak, void of due process. You might have concerns, I might have concerns, and we might feel we have just cause, but we can't call them war criminals until there has been due process and they have been determined to commit war crimes. We don't convict until we've had due process. That's all I say. Let's remember, we're Americans. We believe in the Constitution. We believe in the rule of law. We believe in due process. Let's make the system work for us. That's all I ask. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.